I'm Emily Rooney, and you are listening to Beat the Press, a podcast you can download wherever you like to listen. On this episode, two relatively new startup news organizations with similar missions, Semaphore and News Nation, both promise quality journalism with no spin. Why then is Chris Cuomo News Nation's latest hire?
This outlet has a chance to reach who I call free agents. Not right, not left.
Then New Yorker archivist Aaron Overby publicly complained about a lack of diversity on the editing staff, faced a tough performance review, and was then shown the door. A case of dead right. And finally, we'll revisit two big shakeups in the mediaverse, CNN and its new leadership, and the latest with Elon Musk, his bid to take over Twitter and his backing out of the deal. That in our panel's Rants and Raves. Joining me are Lila Alphonse of the Boston Globe, John Keller of WBZ-TV, and former NECN anchor Mike Nikitas. First, media startups and startovers. News Nation officially launched in September of 2020, promising to deliver straight news.
At News Nation, we are here to bring you back. Back to where we aren't yelling at each other, but telling all of America's stories.
Come back to the facts.
Back to balance.
Come back to the news. News Nation.
News for all America.
News Nation's most prominent host is Mediaite founder Dan Abrams, who hosts Dan Abrams Live. The hard-to-locate cable outlet has about 75 million households, and now in an attempt to add eyeballs, they've hired Chris Cuomo, who was fired from CNN last fall for helping his brother, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, fight sexual harassment charges. In a recent interview with Dan Abrams, Cuomo says he's not a victim of cancel culture, but he denied all the allegations against him.
I never lied, and there were no secrets. I never contacted any media who were covering my brother to try to affect their coverage.
Well, Dan Abrams pushed back on that, but the real issue here is whether this is a viable alternative to CNN, Fox, MSNBC, CNBC, and so forth. Lila, starting with you, Dan Abrams and his staff have been saying in these ads that have been running on various other cable outlets that this is a straightforward news organization, but that does not appear to be the case. In fact, they largely have, I would say, a right-leaning tendency, but now with Chris Cuomo, that's going to balance that out. But why even bother to say that if it's not factually accurate?
I think it's all marketing. I think that you know that a lot of people who lean farther to the left skew to MSNBC. You know, a lot of people who lean farther to the right skew to Fox News, and people are kind of disillusioned with CNN. So there's a deliberate push to create a product that could appeal to the people who still consider themselves to be in the middle. But as you know, that middle, it's really, really slim. So you invariably end up leaning one way or another. And I think that's what's happening. I don't think anyone really expects an unbiased cable news network anymore. So the question is, how can they market themselves in a way that'll get enough people on board who will stay with them long enough to decide that they've fallen in love with some of the faces they see there? Chris Cuomo still is really, really recognizable. And I would say that the vast majority of your average viewers don't really think what happened with his brother was that big a deal.
By the way, Mike, the Daily Beast is speculating that Bill O'Reilly may also be on board with News Nation, so that would change things dramatically. The question is, you know, this really is a difficult to find cable operation. In fact, some of the ads have actually put the channel numbers right, build it right into the ad so you can find it. I mean, the question is Chris Cuomo and possibly Bill O'Reilly enough to make a difference there?
You know, I don't know if it is. I've never been a Chris Cuomo fan, so I saw the interview. In full disclosure, I've never seen News Nation. To your point, I can't find it. I don't have it on my cable lineup. But it is very, very difficult to start a new news operation. I know that firsthand on a much smaller scale. Mm-hmm. You have to, I think, scramble for audience. You have to sometimes get lucky when there's a big story that you can establish yourself. I know firsthand, you got to develop a thick skin. I remember the very first day that NECN went on the air, and I did the first newscast, and the next day the local media critic, wrote, "No Chet Curtis," and had a picture of me. So I know what that's like. You know, we'll see. I think it goes the same for another outlet we're going to be talking about, Semaphore. It's very difficult. I don't know how long News Nation can last. I read that they get about 27,000 homes on any given at any given mm-hmm. time period. I mean, I think that NECN was right around there with 3 million homes in only the six New England states. So I think it's going to be a tough row to hoe. I think that it's very laudable that they're trying to present news that is down the middle. And people constantly would say to me, "Oh, I miss NECN. You guys had no slant." You know, so I don't know if they can do it. I mean, Roger Ailes proved that if you go and hew to confirmation bias, that's how you get the eyeballs. That's how you make right. the money. So I don't know that this can happen.
John?
Yeah, and I bet a significant percentage of those 27,000 sets that are tuned to News Nation are the result of the family dog rolling over on the remote on the couch and accidentally switching it over. I mean, come on. If there is research that the people bankrolling News Nation came up with that suggests there's a really large audience of people who just fed up with slant and partisanship and just want something straight down the middle, I'd like to see that. I doubt it. I think if they do have such research, it's the result of a lot of people lying to them. I think this is one of those poll questions. Where are you fed up with mm-hmm. bias in the news and you want something down the middle? Oh, yeah, I sure do. But I think for the most part, anybody that cares about news does have opinions, does have bias or a slant at some level, and they prefer programming that scratches that itch. Mm-hmm. I can't prove this. That's just my sense. I mean, there have been other experiments like this. CNBC, when they created that show with Shepard Smith, purported to take this same approach. We're going to give it to you without fear or favor, and they haven't drawn flies.
Right, exactly.
So I just question the whole premise. If there's solid, believable research that refutes me, I'd like to see it.
Well, as Mike mentioned, the other one that's even more baffling is the startup Semaphore, which was co-founded by Ben Smith. He's formerly of the New York Times and BuzzFeed. And this site claims, quote, to be a platform that ensures unprecedented transparency, accelerates insight, elevates talent, and explores competing global perspectives, whatever that means. All right, Semaphore's recent pre-launch hosted numerous journalism luminaries, but the biggest guest was Tucker Carlson, who was being interviewed via Zoom by Ben Smith. Now, here's just a sample of how that interview went.
You spend a lot of time laughing about labels that are thrown at you. Racist, white supremacist, the most host of the most racist show in the history of cable television. And actually, I'd rather not ask you about the labels, but sort of give you an opportunity to talk about what you believe. And to begin with, you know, do you believe white people are superior to other races?
No. Please let me, if you don't mind, if I could finish. This is why you are considered correctly a propagandist and not a journalist.
I have to say, John, this was the most toe-curling interview I have ever witnessed in my life. It was hard to believe that it was real. And here they are, you know, using terms like offering a competing global perspective, and they're interviewing Tucker Carlson. It was so awkward. Ben Smith is flipping through notes, fidgeting, was so nervous. He was so out of his element. If they were going to do that as a pre-launch to this idea, he should have had somebody do the interview who really knew what they were doing, because Tucker Carlson absolutely steamrolled him. And by the way, one of the things that Ben Smith said was, "I hope you won't steamroll me because I'm not a professional like you are, and I hope you'll let me ask the questions." He didn't know how to ask a question.
Yeah, it doesn't bode well for the quality of journalism you're going to get from that that website, does it? This business with Carlson at the launch reminded me of some time back, it was a horrific mass murder on a college campus. I'm forgetting which one it was, but the killer sent a videotaped manifesto to NBC News, which shared it with other broadcast outlets, but with their bug all over it. In other words, they co-branded themselves with a mass murderer. Now, I'm not going to suggest that Carlson is a mass murderer, but it's the same kind of really crappy judgment about how you want to brand yourself and market yourself to invite him as the headliner to your launch party. Again, I'm sorry to be Debbie Downer here, but I question the whole premise of this website. There was nothing, with all due respect to Ben Smith, who I don't know from Adam, there was nothing in his work as the media critic for the New York Times that struck me as path-breaking, monumentally illuminating in any way, shape, or form.
No.
They got money. I guess they're going to spend it. I question who will care.
Yeah, I agree with that, Lila. I mean, this is just... There's a lot of words and a lot of, but first of all, where do you even find Semaphore? Anybody know, Lila?
I have no idea. Honestly, I hadn't heard of it until I got the notes for today's episode. But I will point out that Ben Smith did a great job with BuzzFeed, and BuzzFeed's gonna BuzzFeed by generating buzz. And I think if you're trying to reach a global audience, interviewing Tucker Carlson, who resonates uniquely with a very non-global audience, isn't the way to do it, but it is a great way to generate controversy and get people to click to hate watch whatever you do. But I think it's really important to remember what Mark Twain said about never arguing with stupid people, because they drag you down to their level and then beat you with experience. And I see a little bit of that here.
Yeah.
So I see you tried to out Carlson Tucker Carlson. That's not going to work. You gave him instead a huge, not you, him, Smith, gave him a great platform to showcase what he does best, which is steamroll people. So I agree. I don't think this bodes well for the site. But again, people are trying to create this middle ground in the media because they assume it doesn't exist. I think it's also worth noting that Semaphore says it's trying to reach a very affluent, college-educated global audience. So they're trying to appeal to those with money who maybe don't get their news from Fox or CNN or MSNBC. And are trying to give an alternative to those outlets if they think that New York Times has become too liberal or Wall Street Journal is too conservative. They're trying to create a middle ground there. I'm not sure it's going to work.
I don't know, Mike. For one thing, the title sounds like some kind of a nature bar. You know, it's like what the heck is Semaphore?
Well, it's the flags, right? It's the directional. So you need to own a yacht to understand the name to begin with.
Yeah, the branding all around was a little strange to me. I don't know why you have a pre-launch party for a channel or a website that's not going to launch until October 15th. And bringing Tucker Carlson in to Lila's wonderful quote from Mark Twain, I remember, you know, never wrestle with a pig. You'll both get dirty and the pig likes it. And that's kind of how I saw that interview with Tucker Carlson. To me, it was embarrassing. It was a recipe for failure. Why? It was a lose-lose situation. I just don't understand why they thought it was a good idea to have him on for an interview. He ran circles around Ben Smith. You know, you also were talking, Emily, about, you know, how they're building and positioning themselves. And they say about they're talking about a new level of transparency in journalism. And I'm not even sure what that means.
I know.
Means.
I don't know
like
what it means.
Transparency in journalism. I don't understand what it means. So we'll see if they can make it happen. I think along with News Nation, it's the same kind of challenge. You have to get people to notice. Sometimes it takes a big story. You have to be lucky. And, you know, we'll see whether, you know, they've done their research enough to know that there are enough people in the middle that want this kind of, you know, coverage. And they mentioned, 200 million people who are college educated and read in English is what they say on their website. That's their audience. You know, I looked it up. There are only 94 million Americans who have a college education. So that means they're looking for 100 million more plus overseas. I don't know how it's going to happen, but, you know, we'll see.
All right. Next, a reporter for The New Yorker and the public battle that led to her firing. We all know the old adage, never argue with someone who buys ink by the barrel. But that's just what New Yorker archivist Erin Overbay did. First, for years she had been raising concerns internally about lack of diversity at the magazine, especially a lack of black editors. She then faced a tough performance review and was accused of self-plagiarizing and making errors. Next comes this Twitter feed from her, which I'm going to read a couple of these. So New Yorker has fired me, effective immediately. I'm speaking with the union about potentially filing a grievance on the termination, but here are some things that I will say. The New Yorker has never contested the facts, as I have stated them, that I was put under a performance review shortly after sending an email raising concerns about gender inequality and inclusion at the magazine, that several errors that were cited in an email reprimanding me while I was under the performance review were not mine, and that these were errors that David Remnick added to the copy. He's, of course, the editor of The New Yorker. The magazine also did not dispute the fact that after raising my concerns, I was subjected to a performance review that entailed absurdly subjective interpretations of factual inaccuracies, bizarre charges of disrespect, so on and so forth. Well, Lila, I came away from this feeling like she was probably spot on about every issue and concern that she raised. But it was the way she went about it. It reminded me of a discussion we had here some time ago about Felicia Sanmez from the Washington Post, who also raised some legitimate concerns about a colleague who had retweeted a sexist joke, but then she took it public and she was admonishing other people at the Washington Post. She ends up getting fired. This is another example to me of that while she was probably factually correct, and I don't know exactly everything. She was accused of self-plagiarizing, among other things. I'm not intimately familiar with it, but it sounds like she had been raising these concerns, but it was the way she went about it.
I think it's important to remember that every institution, whether we're talking about the media, whether we're talking about the private sector, their bottom line is they are going to protect themselves. There's a need to protect their reputation, their brand, the way they appear in public. And at some point, the pushback reaches a level where it's threatening to the institution, and something has to change. I think the undying hope is that the institution will change its ways, but more likely what happens is that the problem is eliminated. And I think that's in part what we have here. It's really noteworthy, I think, that she points out that The New Yorker has not disputed any of her charges. They have not offered any evidence saying that what she's done is wrong. Instead, they've created new charges that they're trying to shift the focus to. She makes a good point. There was one detail she shared about how in all of their, like, the 15 years worth of award-winning stories, not one of them had been edited by a black editor. The lack of that important perspective really helps create this bubble around the company. And maybe that's what they want. Maybe that's what's appealing to the readers, too. I don't know exactly. But I thought it was really interesting that their concern is self-plagiarism, which is that she reused a portion of a previous newsletter, which doesn't even appear on the site, is just sent out to people, and that she was disrespectful. There's a lot to unpack there with sexism, possibly racism, but the bottom line is they don't dispute any of her charges against the company itself.
John?
The whole concept of diplomacy is sort of in retreat, not just in journalism, but in workplaces everywhere. Replaced by a tsunami of self-righteousness and vindictiveness. So in this New Yorker case, it's possible that this person was pursuing a reasonably valid set of grievances, but did it in a way that rubbed her employers raw, and now she's the target of a vindictive backlash. It also strikes me as possible that she's a self-righteous type who was, you know, rude and insubordinate. And so no wonder they got rid of her. Yeah, I just can't tell. I
think you nailed it.
Say this. Well, I would just say this. I think that, you know, there's value in diplomacy. There's value in listening to your employers, and there's value in being diplomatic with your employer when you raise your grievances. Is that really so hard?
Mm-hmm. I think the one really interesting part of this to me, Mike, was the fact that David Remnick allegedly added the errors which she was being reprimanded for. They did not address that. They did address some of the other issues she raised, but they did not take ownership of that.
No, and I think it goes to John's point about vindictiveness. I mean, this one has so many layers, and I think that we do not know the whole story of her employment there over 17 years. You know, she's probably right about lack of diversity, sexism. The one particular complaint that she raised that resonated with me, she says she was paid 20% less than the person she replaced, and that person had no experience as an archivist. If true, that sounds to me like a legitimate labor concern. But the question, once again, is how do you raise them? What I see from this, and I do not know Aaron Overby, is someone who has, in 2022, decided to air her grievances in full, unrelentingly, on social media. And that is never a recipe for success when your target is your employer. Maybe they had just had enough of her and just decided it was time. I'm sure it will all be adjudicated, through labor relations. They have a union there. And maybe it will lead to some changes at the New Yorker.
Exactly.
And that's a good thing in the final analysis. But I don't approve, and maybe it's just me. I'm like John, I'm old-fashioned, the lack of diplomacy. I don't think this was the way to go about it.
All right, up next, what's shaking at CNN? And will Elon Musk be forced to honor his bid to buy Twitter? Just to catch up on a few stories we've been following on Beat the Press, CNN and its new leadership under Chris Licht, whose mission is no doubt to rebuild CNN, which has been hemorrhaging viewers in recent months. He's already established new breaking news guidelines, which they only sometimes honor, by the way, and he wants anchors to be less partisan and stop using phrases like the big lie. He's met with politicians in an effort to strengthen the network's position with both parties, but his main priorities are finding a permanent host for the 9 p.m. hour where Chris Cuomo used to host, and revamping the morning show.
Good morning to viewers here in the U.S. and around the world. It is Friday, July 29th, and I'm Brianna Keeler alongside John Berman this morning.
Mike, to you, I have to say, I'm a big CNN consumer. That's basically where I go at night. I find the 9 o'clock hour has become unwatchable. I was a fan of Chris Cuomo. I never watched that morning show. I think if they want viewers in the morning, I hate to say it, they've got to get big names. John Berman is straightforward, by the way. I'd have to say he has filled in for a lot of the other hosts at various times, but I find him very straightforward, and maybe that's the reason why no one's watching.
Well, that could be. I found him to be intelligent. I liked Allison Camerota when she was paired with him. I thought she was very good. I do watch CNN a lot like you, and I have noticed some differences. Maybe I was keyed into them by reading about the changes that Chris Licht had made. I think trying to reach out to members of Congress was smart. I think doing away with the big lie phrase was helpful. I think doing away with, or at least limiting, the amount of breaking news banners and phraseology was helpful. I think that there are so many more things that need to be done. I still think inflammatory language and questioning and interviews. When I watch Wolf Blitzer, and he does this thing where he makes a statement of opinion. He states his opinion, then he says, okay, Senator, tell me, how concerned are you about this opinion I just stated? And I start yelling at the TV. My wife doesn't like it. I think that the problem is that viewers have to notice those changes so they stay, if they care about them. And then people who have left or never came to CNN, the ones they're trying to attract by being more moderate and being more fair, have to know that it's happening. And I don't know that they're finding out about that. So who knows? But I think I like the approach he's taken, and I think it's a positive one.
I very respectfully but totally disagree with pretty much everything my esteemed colleague just said. The idea, first of all, I love John Berman. He's a masshole from Massachusetts, and his occasional Dunkin' Donuts references are just hilarious. And I liked Breonna Keeler too. I think she's good. The characterization of her is somehow, you know, extremely slanted to the left, I think is unfair. The notion that Chris Licht is running around sucking up to members of Congress to fear, what the hell does that have to do with journalism or with CNN's success going forward? What are those men and women going to do to help you? I like the breaking news logo. It adds an admittedly false layer of excitement, but it adds some excitement to a medium that desperately needs it. The idea that you're, again, we're talking about this, this notion of branding to the center. No, look, CNN's ratings are in the toilet right now because they don't have a big story to ride, really, or a story that's proving to be compelling enough. My understanding is that CNN and the other cable nets tend to prosper more during an election cycle, particularly if it's a heated one, as they all seem to be now. And then they take a dive. Or if there's some other big ongoing story, that's CNN's bread and butter, always has been, always will be. Chris Licht has a strong reputation, but I don't have the slightest idea what he's doing.
I applaud the attempt to regain the middle ground and reach people. But I've told my students, I've told reporters a million times, once you lose trust from your audience, it's really hard to get it back. To put it in non-media terms, if you had a favorite restaurant and all of a sudden they changed their menu, took off all the things you liked, and what was left was done really kind of poorly, like food was always overdone or underdone, never perfect, the sides were always gross, the produce wasn't fresh, you stop going there, right? The chances of you going back are really slim. First, you have to know that they changed. Then you have to believe that they changed. Then you have to be persuaded to put your money back there and try it. And if all of it isn't right by the time you decide one day to do it without telling them you're going there first, they've lost you again. So I think that reaching out to both sides of the aisle to try to say, hey, we're going to be less partisan. Hey, we're not going to use Democratic language. Hey, we're not going to call everything breaking news. That's great. But until we really see that actually happening for a long stretch, it's just business as usual as far as a lot of your normal average viewers are concerned. I would love to see less everything is breaking. Keep in mind, I'm not the generation they're trying to reach anymore. I am firmly Gen X. My kids are millennials and Gen Z, and they're not getting their news from this outlet because they don't want to see the same two-hour rotation of news over and over. They don't want to hear that stuff they heard about 2 days ago is still breaking. They need to do more than just tell politicians, hey, we'd really like you to be our guest, and also you, in order to regain the audience that they had years ago.
All right, I want to do just a quick lightning round question on this. What will happen to Twitter? You know, shareholders are set to meet in September, where it seems likely they're going to vote to accept this Elon Musk offer of $44 billion. But the only problem is that Musk has retracted the offer over what he claims are bogus and inflated numbers or the bots. That case goes to court in October. John, what's your take on how this is going to end?
I think it'll end poorly. How's that for an answer? They may wind up with a nice payoff from Musk because he seems to have a sketchy grasp of the law. Maybe that'll help keep them afloat. But keep in mind, Twitter's been losing money left and right. I think in a year, 2 years, maybe more, Twitter will be no more, and somehow life will go on.
Lila.
I think it's important to remember that that it built into that contract was that Twitter would have to have made a substantial change in order to allow the sale not to go through, in order to allow either party to withdraw, and they did not make that change. But I've said from the get-go that Musk was playing around with Twitter, like a cat with a toy. The initial stock offering amount was a pot reference. He kept saying that he'd do it, he wouldn't do it. So I think this could be a case of, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, and I'm not sure what's going to happen next.
Mike?
Totally agree. I think he is a dilettante drunk with power and money. I hope he's successful in backing out. I think Twitter is a cesspool, and I'm not sure why he wanted to buy it in the first place.
Or as John would say, a sewer. All right, next, our panel's rants and raves. Time now for our panel's rants and raves, starting with Lila Alphonse.
So I have a rave for Jon Stewart, who most of us remember from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart fame on Comedy Central. He left that show in 2015. Last fall, he launched a new one called The Problem with Jon Stewart on Apple TV. Just an 8-episode season. But what I'm raving about is that he's walking the walk in a lot of ways. He's not just identifying a problem and then getting a few talking heads on to talk about it. He's been a pretty consistent and strong advocate for veterans, for first responders. And recently he was back in Congress holding lawmakers' feet to the fire over the rejection of a healthcare plan for military veterans who have been adversely affected by the chemicals in burn pits. It's something he's also touched on in his show, but I'm really looking forward to see what he does next tackling these big problems. A lot of people want him to just go back to being a comedian. He's almost 60 now. I think it's time to let him evolve, let him try something new, and see where that takes us.
Maybe News Nation should hire him. All right. Mike, what do you got?
I would like to offer a personal rave, and it goes back once again to my 10 years coaching softball, my daughters, in Windham, New Hampshire. How does that have to do with journalism? Some of the stellar girls I had the pleasure of coaching and who are now grown and carving paths in journalism. 3 years ago on this program, I raved about a former player of mine who started a news app at MIT, which is still going strong. Today, I want to rave about another player and family friend I coached for a couple of years, Sarah Skiri. Sarah is now deputy editor and writer at the Harvard Nieman Journalism Lab. She has written, among other things, an excellent recent analysis of Tucker Carlson's appearance at the Semaphore pre-launch, which we talked about earlier. It's worth reading. And she was also a very excellent shortstop and hitter. I know her family is proud of her, and I am too. So the softball to journalism pipeline is alive and well, and Sarah gets my rave for this week. Way to go, Sarah.
All right, John, top that.
Could Sarah go to her left and right equally well, Mike? Because that seems to be a requirement in this media landscape.
She was a right-handed power hitter.
Okay, good to hear. Look, I have a rant that's really more of a question. Media recklessness is certainly nothing new, but it feels like it's getting out of hand. Right-wing media like The Daily Wire are now openly calling for civil war. Anti-Semitic left-wing social media is openly targeting Jewish institutions. It doesn't feel like there are enough places like this one, Beat the Press, where this garbage is being spotlighted and called out. So my question is there anything that can be done about it? To at least attach some PR consequences to this behavior. Some countries, Australia, Canada, have these national news councils with mixed results. Australia has a primetime network TV program devoted to media criticism that's been popular for over 3 decades. Right now, we're in a situation where it's recklessness without consequences. I'd like to see that change.
All right, so finally, I have a rant this week for Will Smith and his what appeared to be more like a hostage video apology to Chris Rock.
So I will say to you, Chris, I apologize to you. My behavior was unacceptable, and I'm here whenever you're ready to talk.
It started off with this weird graphic, and then the setup itself, it looked like he was sitting in front of some kind of a sun lamp. You know, his head was bobbing around. I mean, I think he meant it as a genuine, direct apology to Chris Rock, who has refused to talk to him since, but it was just poorly executed. It wasn't well written, it wasn't well delivered, and it ended up being an embarrassment. And in fact, I think it hurt his cause more than it helped him, even though I think the idea was genuine. It just didn't work at all. And I'm shocked that somebody wasn't there with him. It looked like he did it himself. It looked like a self-produced video. Even just the way it was all set up on camera, it was very, very amateurish. And unfortunately, and I had been somewhat supportive of Will Smith, and I think, you know, he was genuinely sorry. He's definitely paid the price, but this definitely did not help his cause. All right, and that is it for this edition of Beat the Press. You can download us wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to Lila Alphonse, Mike Nikitas, and John Keller. Join us on Twitter at Beat the Press. Beat the Press is brought to you in part by Wilder Strategies, a Boston-based communications and public relations company focused on cutting through the clutter to get your message heard. Wilder Strategies, helping tell the stories that matter. Contact wilderstrategies.com. I'm Emily Rooney. Thanks for listening.
Beat the Press is powered by Mudhouse Media.